Welcome to the 9th Scottish Housing News podcast with me, Jimmy Black, and Kieran Finlay, the editor of Scottish Housing News. Before we start, we're delighted to announce that today's podcast is sponsored by DTL Creative, your go-to partner for improving the social housing sector through leading-edge technology and innovation. Today, our guest is Ailsa Raeburn, Chair of Community Lands Scotland, who has been an influencer and a decision-maker in community enterprises throughout the country. Most recently, she was celebrating the 20th anniversary of the community buyout of the island of Gia, and we'll talk more about that. Now, everyone seems to accept that there is a rural housing shortage. Young people can't find homes to rent, and affordable homes for sale are snapped up by holiday homers. Vast amounts of land lie empty while planners squeeze any new build homes onto cramped sites. Social housing is limited and much reduced by previous sales, and now land is being bought up for rewilding, and no one seems quite sure of where people fit in beside the pines, the lynx and the wolves. So we need someone like Ailsa to tell us how we reach the point where young people cannot find homes within their own communities and what we can do about it. So Ailsa, let's start with Gia. Let's start with the celebrations for the 20th anniversary. How did those go?
Oh, hi. Well, thanks so much for inviting me along today. That's quite a big agenda we've got to cover. I think a lot of what you were talking about there can really be encapsulated in what's happened on Gia. 20 years since they bought the island, they'd had a series of difficult relations with landowners who hadn't invested in the housing stock. So all of the houses on the island were below tolerable standard at the time. And in the 20 years since the community bought the island, which they were celebrating yesterday, they've refurbished all the housing, they're building new housing, they've refurbished the farms, they've sorted out the hotel, and that's now got a really successful tenant in it. They've built moorings, they're supporting the fish farm businesses. So it was a really great day yesterday. We were lucky, the rain stayed off, and we were able to celebrate with the school and lots of people on the island who recognise that actually, you know, it's been a bumpy journey sometimes. Community ownership's not always straightforward. These are all people that are involved, local people. But it was a really lovely day yesterday to be able to sort of stand back and reflect on that journey over the last 20 years, why the community felt compelled to buy the island in the first place. The huge amount of support they've had from organisations like the Lottery and Highlands and Islands Enterprise, and to give themselves a bit of a pat on the back to say, actually, you know, sometimes people scoffed and thought, oh, a community will never be able to buy this island, and they'll never be able to run it, they'll never be able to refurbish the houses, they'll never be able to do this, that and the other, and actually they've achieved a huge amount, and now they've got some more really exciting projects going on around refurbishment of Achamore Gardens and a new campsite, and as I say, some new housing. So they've really got the bit between their teeth for their sort of third decade of ownership.
That's a very impressive list of achievements. How big, how crucial was housing in the decision to buy out the land?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I wasn't involved at the time, but certainly speaking to people who were involved at the time, and the funders that supported the acquisition, the poor quality of the housing was a really big issue. And of course, you know, particularly at that time, there were so few regulations around private tenancies. Landlords could let properties which were really, really poor. There was obviously no rent regulation. Landlords had the power, you know, if your place didn't fit or you fell out with them in some way, you know, you could be evicted from your house. Before the community acquired the island, the power imbalance was absolutely huge, and people would come and go. There was no sort of sense of stability or consistency. So and now, of course, you know, people have been in those houses for 20 years and they've all been refurbished, and new people are coming to the island all the time. The other good thing that Gia have done is identified quite a lot of plots for development. So they work with the planners to identify suitable plots, because lots of people want to move to rural areas, not to rent houses, but actually to build their own house and own their own house. So Gia has been a really good mix of providing their own rented housing, and they also had a great partnership with the local housing association who built I think about 18 houses in total, and then they've also released over 20 plots, quite a lot of which have already been built on. So they recognize that in rural areas it's not just just about one tenure type, but actually people come with lots of different reasons and they come with different resources. So GEARS can be celebrated for lots of things, but I think particularly in terms of, you know, raising the population, it was about 90 and now it's 160 since the community bought it. So the school role's gone up. So there's really successful businesses now on the island. And housing really, as we know, is at the core of all of that, because as we're seeing in lots of areas of the Highlands and Islands at the moment, if you don't have housing that's affordable and accessible, businesses can't find staff, you know, schools close, doctor's surgeries close, you just start to lose your essential infrastructure. So housing was critical and is still critical.
Ilse, there's no denying the success of the GEAR project, but not everybody on GEAR is happy with it. And, you know, I think the original founder, the first chair, wasn't going to attend the celebrations. I hope he did, but it said in the paper that he might not. And part of his reason was he didn't agree with the direction of travel, the selling off of properties, the selling off of community assets. What about community projects, community enterprises? Where's the governance? How can you be sure that if something goes wrong, that somebody can step in and kind of sort it?
Community landowning organisations are really democratic, because, you know, you have to put your name forward as a director very, very regularly, and you can be voted off. And of course, that's happened on GEAR. You know, boards come and go. I'm also involved in EGG, and the board changes there quite regularly because people recognise, well, you go on the board, you know, there's specific things that you might want to pursue, particular projects, and you do that, and then you leave the board and give someone else an opportunity to come on. So that is a really good thing, in a way, perhaps, that you don't get on community councils, or say with councillors who tend to be in place for years and years and years and years. In communities, boards are actually changing all the time, and of course you won't have everyone agree with what you're doing. 10 years ago there were big issues on GEAR about the level of debt, and people were really unhappy with the level of debt, and a lot of that debt had been raised to refurbish the houses. So there were people that were unhappy with that, and now they're talking about, they've actually done a great job in bringing the debt down to a really manageable level by selling off properties. And there's one at the moment that's on the market, which the community trust just could not afford to refurbish. So this comes back to the point I was making about GEAR, is they see a range of tenure options as being really important. So it's some people, and I'm not saying one is right and the other is wrong, but some people have a very purist view of community ownership and you have to hang on to everything, and other people say, well, actually community ownership is about enabling, it's about enabling people to come and live in places, it's enabling repopulation, it's enabling businesses, it's providing the facilities and the assets for other people to do that. So you know, there's some philosophical questions there around community ownership, but certainly the funders and Scottish Government and HIE see, you know, that bigger picture and the enabling role of community landowners, and say, well, if it makes more sense for you to dispose of an asset and then reinvest those proceeds into doing something that the community really wants, whatever that might be, then actually that's a really sensible use of your assets. And that's, of course, what a private owner would do. It would think about what its assets are, what it wants to do, and how it's going to raise funds to do those things. And, you know, holding on to assets that you can't afford to refurbish and seeing them falling into really poor repair is not good management from my perspective. But, you know, I agree, you know, I accept that other people will have a different view.
What's been Community Land Scotland's role on GEAR, and more generally? I know that you represent community landowners, possibly in discussions with the Scottish Government. But is there a hands-on role in facilitating the setup of these boards and so on?
Well, Community Land Scotland's role is sort of threefold, really. It's to support existing community owners and aspiring community owners. So a lot of the work we would do is with organisations or groups or individuals that want to set up community trusts and want to acquire assets. So, yeah, so we'll give them advice on the forms of governance arrangements that are available, whether that's, this is a bit nerdy now, but whether that's a charity or a company limited by guarantee or a Bencom or a KIC. So there's lots of different routes. Governance routes you can take depending on how you want to fund your acquisition. We'll put them in touch with other organisations that are doing similar things. So this, the community land sector is great because there's a lot of sharing of experience and, you know, not trying to reinvent the wheel all the time. So that's really useful. We also do a lot of support and promotion around the benefits of community ownership. So how communities are addressing depopulation and the affordable housing crisis, you know, how they're getting involved in biodiversity and climate change projects, renewables, etc. And then we also have an advocacy role, so trying to change policy around community ownership and land reform. So, yeah, we don't have any sort of role in terms of, you know, involvement in each of the individual boards, but we try and obviously encourage good practice and encourage sharing of good practice.
Many of our listeners are involved in housing associations, particularly community-controlled ones and cooperatives. Do you see any similarities between these bodies?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the community controlled ones, which, and I could be completely wrong here, but I always sort of understood they were really sort of west of Scotland, and most of the original community controlled housing associations. And as a model, that's not really spread much out of the west of Scotland. Certainly we've had lots of conversations with the West of Scotland Housing Forum about lessons that can be shared between what they're doing and for communities. I mean, they're very different sorts of organisations, because obviously a lot of those housing associations, the community ones, are really large. You know, they own possibly thousands of properties, whereas lots of community organisations might own 10. So there's a big difference in scale. But housing associations in rural areas have been really, really helpful in supporting communities with their housing projects. So sometimes that's been in partnerships, like up in Gairloch, I think, in Staffin, communities have worked with at local RSLs. I know on Egg, and the local RSL there has been really helpful in terms of giving us advice and support on how to take forward projects. But I think that's the gap between in scale between what they're doing and what individual community or local organisations are doing is really quite huge. And quite often communities would probably be really happy if an RSL came in and said, we'll build four houses on Egg, or we'll build 10 houses on Collins, they say. But we appreciate that there are sometimes restrictions around RSLs getting involved in that scale of project. And that's why communities have to step in, because basically there's market failure in that there are no other organisations that are doing that type of work. But everybody recognises that new housing is required. So I would think, yeah, there's really lots of great learning, fantastic support from the RSL sector. And an acknowledgement that perhaps they can't work at the sort of scale that a lot of local communities need.
Why is there such a chronic housing shortage, Ailsa? I know that's a very broad question, but I imagine it would give you a chance to explore some of the themes that Community Land Scotland think is important.
Some of it is around sort of that really entrenched pattern of land ownership. And we know some landowners, certainly not all, but some landowners have not wanted tenancies in their properties, and they've been really happy to turn everything over to short-term lets. So that has been a huge issue. We've seen new owners come in, what we're calling, you know, the green lairds, but people that are specifically interested in land and estates for carbon and tree planting. And again, they don't necessarily want people on the land. So that's two sort of really big meta issues, really, that need addressing, this whole issue of land reform and how communities can get access to more land in rural Scotland. There's the issues that are really well rehearsed around the sale of housing stock, and that's not been replaced. There are massive issues around short-term lets and properties that have always been in full-time residential use, moving over to short-term lets, because, you know, it's a no-brainer, really. The financial returns from a short-term let, particularly before the licensing came in terms of the maintenance and repair obligations for a short-term let compared to a private rented tenancy, were hugely different. So, you know, if you had a property and you could get, you know, £1,000 a week in the summer as a short-term let, or £500 a month from a local school teacher, you know, as I say, it's a bit of a no-brainer, particularly if you've got no sort of cultural or social investment in that community. You know, it's just an investment for you. So I think that has been a massive problem, and particularly in pressure areas. The conversation we were having this morning, in some locations, you know, 40% of the housing stock is now second homes and short-term lets, and you cannot build your way out of that, you know, with all the money. And I took, you know, give huge credit to the Scottish Government, the Royal and Islands Housing Fund, you know, they're extremely supportive, but you cannot build your way out of those numbers. So the short-term let legislation and the opportunity for control area orders in particularly pressured areas will be a useful tool. Community Land Scotland are also doing some work at the moment on second homes and what can be done to restrict or control the number of second homes, and we're about to put a proposal to Scottish Government on that. So the issue on the supply side is really important, and as I say, no matter how much support you get from the Scottish Government, the availability of land and things like construction costs and the time it takes and the planning issues means you can never build your way out of that. You know, all the communities we go to and that we're engaged with, you know, housing is it's either ferries or housing. That's always the hugest issue. And even in places like Egg, where, you know, depopulation is not an issue, the population on Egg has gone up by almost 100% since the community aimed it. But the issue there is it's just not enough houses. So people are living in caravans and yurts and sheds. And, you know, so there's no one single silver bullet. There's lots of different actions that need to be taken.
Okay, let's just look at rewilding then. Where are the risks in that for the rural community?
Yeah, I think there's huge risks. There are also opportunities, and I would really want to reflect that as well. But the risks are, as in with all land ownership in Scotland, is the market's completely unregulated. So you may get really far-sighted owners that see the balance between biodiversity, climate action, sequestering carbon, but the need to have people there to do all of that work, because that work doesn't do it by itself, you know, it needs people. Where are those people going to live? So I say there are some far-sighted owners that really see that you need the two together. Rewilding and repeopling are absolutely linked, and one will not succeed. Rewilding certainly won't succeed if you don't have people there. But there are some other owners, and I say this comes back to the fact that the moment the market is completely unregulated, they don't see that and think, well, I'll put 10,000 acres of sitka on that, because, you know, I get great felling income and I get fantastic carbon credits, and I can do that 10,000 acres in Scotland, or I could do that 10,000 acres in Canada or Madagascar or somewhere else, and the fact is in Scotland is irrelevant, it's just an investment opportunity. So that sort of rewilding, nature-based solution type, carbon-led, what we call the green sort of rush, the green land rush, that's not good for Scotland. It's not good for the people of Scotland, it's not good for communities, because they have no interest apart from the financial return. So as I say, there's a spectrum of landowners, and obviously we're really keen to work with those at the sort of repeopling end of the spectrum that recognises that, you know, land, it might look there, but actually it has a cultural inheritance, it has a community inheritance, it has people that live there, it could support more people. So we're really keen to work with those owners, and there are some good examples, and we're really keen to discourage the owners at the other end of the spectrum that just see land as an investment opportunity. And we know people can be messy, we know tenants can be difficult, we know that, you know, if you live there then you might have a view about what the landscape looks around you, and they don't want any of that, you know, they just see it as a bare piece of land. So as I say, there are definite threats, and I think organisations like the Land Commission, Scottish Land Commission, recognise that, and they're trying to bring forward proposals to try and manage it. But from Community Land Scotland perspective, we have lots of proposals that we're putting forward to Scottish Government around public interest tests, around controls on ownership, around how the market might work better, and in particular on things like management plans. So if you own a 20,000 acre estate, you know, you have to agree with the community, well, we need housing somewhere, where are we going to put this housing, how are we going to give the land over to that. So we think, you know, there's lots of opportunities to do things better.
How can we solve this problem then? We've spelled out lots of issues there, particularly with young people needing homes in their communities where they've been brought up. What's your vision, and particularly in the landscape of net zero as well, where does all that fit in?
Well, I mean, Scotland's got an amazing opportunity around net zero. It's land assets, could do a huge amount to help Scotland and globally help the net zero targets. So I think that's a great opportunity, and I know the Scottish Government are looking at green jobs and how it can encourage more young people to go into green jobs. It comes back to where they're going to live. If they've got a green job, you still need somewhere to live. So I would say the vision should be around much more encouragement and incentive for young people to come and take those green jobs and get good long-term sustainable jobs in our communities. You know, you look at the landscape of Scotland 200 years ago, there were little communities absolutely everywhere. And, you know, now obviously we've all got cars, we can all travel 10 miles to school. So there are different options, different ways of looking at how rural Scotland should be redeveloped. But there's really good examples. You know, I live in a forestry village. If I think what the Forestry Commission did in the 50s, you know, they created sustainable communities with some infrastructure, and they've been really successful. You know, so if we're not talking, you know, about expanding existing communities, which there should be lots of opportunities to do, there are also opportunities to resettle new communities on land where you can bring in young people, bring in young families, keep the schools open, you know, keep the shops and the pubs and the hotels open in the winter, etc. So I think for me, a much more mixed demographic, because as we know, particularly in the Highlands and Ireland, it's a very aging demographic. So more young people, enabling young people to stay in their communities, but also encouraging more young people to come and live, because it's a fantastic quality of life. It's a great way of life. You know, fantastic culture, great environment, brilliant scenery, nice landscape, great people. You know, people want to come and live here. You know, on Rum, they just built four houses and they have 440 applications for those houses. On Ulva, they're building six houses, three of which have already got tenants, and they had over 1,000 people interested. There's not a lack of demand. There's not a lack of people wanting to come and live here at all. It's having that housing to enable them to do that.
Crucial to all of this, though, is that the people are involved in creating these new projects and new communities. Top-down decision-making has been a plague, hasn't it, in terms of the last couple of hundred years, and also the fact that local government has become so distant. So how do you ensure that people can really participate in the decisions that are being made about their community, and it's not maybe a funder who thinks buying out the island is a good idea, rather than the people themselves wanting to do it? I ask because one of the things that was said in GIA by the new chair, the current chair of the trust in GIA, is that a community buyout should be a last resort, not a first resort.
Well, I have great respect for Ian. He's done a brilliant job on GIA. I don't agree with him there, and he knows I don't agree with him there. And I think, you know, that's just perhaps some experience that he's had, not some easy experiences. But I would say that actually we should be looking now, if something comes up for sale, community ownership should be the first thing. Local people, are you interested? Do you want to buy it? There's lots of support out there, huge amount of support to enable you to do that. So let's have a think about it. You might decide actually it's not for us. You know, we're not particularly cohesive, or we don't have enough people that want to go on the board. It is time consuming, definitely. But you should be giving local people the say as to whether or not they want to buy assets that become available. So one of the things we'd be quite keen to explore is notification of sales, which doesn't happen at the moment, but you know, some of the big public bodies like Forestland Scotland have to notify if they're putting things on the market. So there's an opportunity to look at that, see how that might work. But, you know, communities are getting much more ambitious now. If you look at the number of properties that the Scottish Land Fund is supporting, you know, they're not necessarily huge acquisitions. They might just be, you know, bits of land here and there, or properties, or, you know, shops or pubs or whatever. But they're all important to that local community. They've decided, actually, we don't want to lose the shop, or we don't want to lose the pub, or, you know, we want to keep our play park, or we want to build houses, or whatever it is they want to do locally. And more communities are now thinking, well, let's not wait for the council to come and do it, or for the landowner to come and do it, or for another unknown person to come and do it. Let's do it ourselves. And that's why, you know, it's really mainstream now. It's a really sort of tried and tested model of ownership. And I think coming back to your point about giving local people a voice, that's why it is important and to have sort of development trusts and community owners, because local authorities are very distant. You know, I live in Argyll and Bute, which is a massive, massive authority area. And whilst the councillors are really good and they do their utmost to try and support as many communities as possible, just by dint of its size, it can't possibly be on the ground in the way that community trusts can be. So I think coming back to the point we were talking about earlier on about local governance as well, actually you can be a member of your trust, you can get on the trust board, you can be the chair, you know, you don't need any special skills, you don't need to be professionally qualified in anything, you just need to care about your local area and want the best for it, whatever that is. So I think, yeah, there is a move, you know, local authorities are really huge in Argyll and Bute and Highland in particular, and it's really difficult to make those connections with the centres of power in those authority areas. But, you know, individual communities in Gee is a great example, Egg, Knoydart, Rum, you know, all the ones that have done it up in Lewis and Harris, you know, they're actually in control of quite a lot now. So local authorities will come and talk to them. They've got a seat at the table by dint of owning important assets. So, you know, more of that. And it doesn't need to be all of the land, but, you know, it needs to be key local assets so communities can protect them. You know, in Strontian, they were really concerned about the school offer that Highland Council made to them and really unhappy about it. So they built their own school and leased it back to the council. And if that lease expires and the council doesn't want to renew it for any reason, it can be converted into three houses. You know, so there's just great stuff going on, really brilliant stuff that, and we need to be doing more of that probably, because, you know, local authority budgets have been hugely constrained for all sorts of reasons, and they just can't do the stuff that they've done in the past, and we all need to recognise that.
Okay, I think we're coming to the end now, and so I've just got one last question for you, Ailsa. Do you miss your time in the Birmingham canals?
Gosh, that's a blast from the past. Well, I was really lucky in some ways and unlucky in other ways, because I was really at the start of canal-based regeneration. When I first went to work for British Waterways, as it was then, canals were seen as really dirty, you know, horrible places where, you know, as a single woman, you would never walk even in the daytime, full of shopping trolleys and cars and horrible things. And as I say, I'm not taking any credit for it at all, because it was a brilliant team that did it. But the actual start of that regeneration, when the International Convention Centre was built and all Brindley Place was built, and people started to see actually canals can be really important. They can, you know, if you look after them and they look nice, you know, they are really fantastic green corridors and safe places for people to walk and cycle, and, you know, connect important places to people. So yeah, I've seen it when canals were really not valued and were really tricky places to be and really difficult to get investment to. Now, you know, I live near the Crinan Canal and it's absolutely beautiful and a real asset for the local community. So yeah, oh gosh, that's made me remember some things from the past and some people.
Good, well, I'm glad we brought back some memories. Anyway, that's the end of the Nice Scottish Housing News podcast. So I have to thank you, Ailsa Rayburn, for your participation, Kieran Finlay, the editor of Scottish Housing News, and for the first time, we have to thank our sponsor too, DTL Creative, your go-to partner, for improving the social housing sector through leading-edge technology and innovation. So we'll be back again in another couple of weeks.